All right, we will get some phone calls in a little bit later on. But first up, I'm joined by the head basketball coach at NC Central. He was named head coach in March of 2009. He led the Eagles to the regular season title this season. Last year, NC Central became the first program in the conference to win three straight tournament titles in 30 years. Lavelle Moten is my guest. Lavelle, it's great to have you on the show. First off, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on. How are you and your family doing, and what was the last week and a half been like for you?
First of all, thanks for having me on. I truly respect you guys and everything that you've done in our business. My family and I, we're doing well. We're incredibly blessed. Thanks for asking. Obviously, the setbacks in our country has affected us as a family, has affected me as a man, as a black man, as a head of household who have to raise children and prepare them for a world that exists as we currently see it. So, it's been difficult to say the least, but we're survivors and we'll get through.
Lavelle Moten is my guest. I can certainly appreciate that sentiment. I want to be very, very respectful, because what we're talking about is connected to personal experiences that you have had. And as you tweeted the other day, the killing of George Floyd has triggered your anxiety disorder. Would you be okay with talking about the incident in 2005 that you tweeted about the other day? Can we do that?
Sure. In 2005, I was a high school basketball coach at Sanderson High School in my hometown, Raleigh, North Carolina. And my best friend is my younger brother, my godbrother. He's the godfather to my kids, Raymond Felton, NBA star and Carolina point guard. It was 2005. They had just won a national championship. He and I are riding around in Raleigh. And at the time, I have a truck and the windows are tinted on it. And I'm on the phone with my mom. And look, I come from an impoverished neighborhood, so we're very aware of the police and how they move on our side of town. So I'm on the phone with my mom, and Rhea's in the passenger seat, and I tell her, I said, Mom, I'm going to call you back because I know I'm about to get poor. And she said, no, I need you to stay on the phone with me. And I said, no, I'm going to hang up because I know I'm about to get poor. So I make a couple of turns to see if the cop is following me, and obviously he is. So he puts the siren on, we pull over. I keep my mom on speakerphone, and I put my phone on the armrest. And, before I know it, a cop just comes and he yanks my door open. And he tries to yank me out the car, and I don't go completely out the car because I have my seatbelt on. So I unhook my seatbelt, he yanks me out the car. And when he yanks me out the car, his buddy has a gun to my head. He's telling me to turn around and spread eagle and put my hands on the hood. Now, they haven't asked me anything about driver's license registration or any routine act that they're supposed to. And as I'm turning around, asking him, like, what's going on, they tell him to shut the F up. And he's taking his feet, and he's kicking my ankles, making me spread my legs. And he's frisking me and then asking me, can he search my car? And I said, no, you can't search my car. Like, for what? Like, what are you talking about? And so he said, well, y'all dope boys, ain't you? You got some dope, insinuating that we had drugs in the car or whatever. Like, it was just crazy. So he handcuffed me. I hear my mom frantically coming through the phone. Right. Mind you, this whole time, they don't even know Raymond is in the car because they ran up on my side of the car and the windows are kind of tinted, so they can't even see him. They can just hear my mom. So they handcuff me. He take my hand. He drag me to the back of the car. He shoves me down on the curb and make me sit there. Mind you, it's raining outside. I have on all white, and he's just continuing to question me. I need to search your truck. I need to search your truck. And every time he's becoming more and more enraged, and he's deliberately kicking like puddles of water on me to almost humiliate me. So I'm becoming all muddy and all this. They must have called for backup because he's asking me for my driver's license and registration at this time. And I say, I memorized my driver's license number. I'll give you my number, but I'm not going in this car for you to shoot me, right? Because, again, I'm well aware of how the police treated people in the neighborhoods that I grew up in. I ain't qualified to speak from everyone else, but these are just my life experiences. So long story short, his partner comes up, and his partner has a sidekick with him, and as soon as he gets out the car, he drives on the curb where I'm sitting. And it's almost like he was trying to run me over. He stopped the car probably 5 or 6 feet away from me. He get out the car. Now, he has a gun drawn because he sees this guy with the gun drawn. So his partner gets out the car as well, and he's starting to look at me as if he notices me. And he gathers everyone up in the huddle, and they walk away. And I don't know exactly what they were saying, but I just heard them say Lavelle Moe. And he looks back, and he come back. He said, "Man, what is your name?" And while I'm sitting on the curb handcuffed, I'm kind of pissed off, obviously, and I say, "Man, my name is Lavelle Moe." And then, again, I'm hearing my mom cry through this phone frantically. Like, I've never heard of my mother like that. She's begging for them not to kill her child. And that kind of made me a bit emotional. And all of a sudden, Ray rolls down his window, and he says, "Dale, man, please calm down. Please calm down." And when Ray did that, that kind of scared them because they never knew he was in the car anyway. So they run up on his side with their hand on the gun, and they look. And they said, "Man, this is Raymond Felton." Fortunately for us, Carolina had just won a national championship, you know, a month ago. So, you know, we on Tobacco Road. So athletes at Carolina and Duke and NC State are really well known and recognized. And so long story short, he just extended his hand and told me he apologized. And he said, "Man, we got a call that you fit the description, and I don't want no harsh feelings. I don't want you thinking I'm a butthole." And I told him, "Nah, it's too late for that." So he got in his car and they left, and I sat on that curb and I kind of cried because it was the first time in my life, you know, I felt humiliated as a man. I felt less than as a man at the hands of another man. And I had heard those stories from my grandfathers and all of my elders who told me generational stories like that, but it had never occurred to me. And the second thing was, I've never heard my mom cry that way. And that scared me and frightened me. So I kept it to the chest. I never told anyone or made it public. And the reason I never did that was because Raymond was up to get drafted the following month. And I didn't want anyone questioning the story or, you know, trying to spin it as they do in the media and perpetuate a negative image. And I didn't want to affect his draft value because I knew how much his family was relying on him for their generation of wealth. And so I just kept it close to the church, and I just exposed it and put it on Twitter last week once the George Floyd incident happened.
And here as well, Lavelle Moten is my guest, and I appreciate you sharing that story, Lavelle, very much. Now, you write that you sat on the curb for 30 minutes, and as you just said right now, it's the first time in my life I felt less than a man. Like, your humanity was not seen. Instead, what they saw was, quote, two dope boys. What kind of an emotional scar does that leave on you?
You know, like, when you come from the neighborhoods in which I come from, I hate to say it, but you're targeted constantly. You're marginalized, and you're marginalized so much that it becomes normalcy to you, right? It was a sense of normalcy. The only reason I told that story with the cops was that was the first time I had a gun pulled on me. When I was 12 years old, my neighborhood was Lane Street Projects, and it's probably four or five blocks away from the governor's mansion. So when I was 12 years old, to raise money for my AAU trips, I would often go sell magazine subscriptions. That's just what we did back then because my mother couldn't afford to sponsor me on an AAU trip. So I sold these magazine subscriptions in this place called Historic Oakwood. And one day when I'm walking back, I'm counting my money, and we got a tournament approaching on the weekend, and I'm counting my money, and there's a cop that's coming along beside me, and he's parallel to me, and he's probably going like two miles an hour. And the first thing he says is, "Hey, boy, where you get that money from?" And I really ignored him because it was disrespectful. Even though I was 12, I'm not your boy. Like, and we all know the intent and content behind him calling me a boy. So I continued to walk, and he said, "Boy, you hear me?" I said, "Where did you get that money from?" And I continued to walk, and he pulled up, and he cut me off, and he got out the car. And again, he made me spread eagle. And he went in my pockets. He was checking for crack and drugs. And he went in my pockets. And I had a wad of cash from my magazine subscriptions in my pockets, and I had some in my hand. And he took my money, and he drove off. And I went in the house, Jim, and I was crying. But you got to understand, I was crying because I didn't think I would be able to go on my AAU trip. I wasn't crying because he humiliated me, because in our neighborhood, that was every day, all day. And those are the harsh realities that we had to live with, you know, in growing up in our neighborhood and just having our dealings with the cop. We weren't treated as human beings. We were treated as targets.
Lavelle Moten is my guest. You know, it's such a difficult conversation to have, but it's such an important conversation to have. And then Sunday, you challenged white coaches in football and basketball to speak out. I want to read the quote. "I have a problem with their silence because it seems as if Black Lives Matter to them whenever they can benefit from it, or whenever they're getting them first downs, catching an alley-oop, or shooting a three or whatever. When it's time for humanity to speak up on behalf of the student-athlete, it's silent. It's crickets. And my problem is, if the murdering of Black Americans is too risky of an issue for them to stand up as a leader, then who are they really playing for?" End quote.
Right.
It's a really powerful statement and a powerful truth. What would you like to see coaches doing in these situations?
You know, it's amazing because as coaches, we all preach every single year to our team, 100% buy-in. And we all say, either you got 10 toes in or you're not in at all, right? And we put our hands in a huddle and we say, 1, 2, 3, family. And, you know, it just dawned on me, like, listen, man, let's stop tiptoeing this line, right? And any change that's been beneficial for Black people in this country, you know, people that didn't look like us was advocating for us and speaking up on our behalf. You know, for instance, Las Vegas is so integrated and we love it as a strip and a place of entertainment now, but that city is like that because Frank Sinatra said in the 60s, look, I know y'all love me performing here, but if you want me to continue to perform here, my buddy over here, Sammy Davis Jr., must be allowed to perform on the same stages and sleep in the same hotels and eat at the same restaurants. And the rest is history. The same thing with the 68 Olympics with John Carlos and Tommy Smith when they protested on the stand. A lot of people have to know that Peter Norman was a citizen of Australia, and he was protesting along with them for human rights. You and I are both old enough to remember MTV as music television, right? When they played videos all day. I just remember being a kid and they were interviewing David Bowie and they were saying how great of a pop star he is and how he has these incredible videos. And he said, well, yeah, I'm a good pop star and I'm a great artist and I got some really good videos. But there's a guy by the name of Michael Jackson that has great music, great videos, and you guys refuse to play him. And I insist that you guys play his music and his videos as well. And from that point, it just moved the needle forward. So I just knew if we wanted true change, if we wanted to support these Black lives and these kids and a generation that has the same complexion as George Floyd, we have to do that together. And I, as a leader, have never asked anyone to do something I'm not willing to do. Jim, if you go back in 2012, the tragedy of Sandy Hook, my basketball team, who was predominantly Black, obviously, we wore green bracelets to pay homage and love and support to those victims of Sandy Hook and their families. I've done every ALS challenge. I've done all the Coaches versus Cancer challenge. So I was just challenging all the coaches in my profession, football and basketball coaches, look, let's be real with ourselves and let's not take ourselves too seriously. Like, we're not good coaches. We're good because we have this guy that's really good that can shoot a basketball or run a football. And we've been able to create a great living, not only for ourselves, but our kids and kids that go down the road. And it's really off the talent and the labor of these student athletes. Let's show them the same act of solidarity by not only speaking out, but doing something. I don't want this to be a hollow lip service PSA and then nothing is ever done with it. Let's show up for them the way they've shown up for us. And that's all I would say.
Lavelle Mottin is my guest. Lavelle, before you go, I want to get your thoughts. What kind of response have you received from coaches after you spoke out and shared your feelings?
You know what? It's been incredible. And I'm proud and I'm optimistic and where our sport and our game is going in terms of basketball coaches. I've had basketball coaches, fans, athletic directors. It's been an overwhelming response of love and support and saying, look, what do I need to do? How can I do X, Y, Z? And we have some things that we're creating right now, you know, as basketball coaches that we think can help. But we just need to stop tiptoeing this line and stop closing the blind eye because enough is enough. And there's no time to be politically correct when you are seeing the murder of young Black men on this TV. We have to speak up because we've always been advocates. So the outcome and the outcry and the messages have been 1,000% supportive. And I'm in a place where, you know, I'm surrounded by Duke in North Carolina on Tobacco Road. I'm 5 or 10 minutes from each one. And I'm really good friends with Coach K and Roy Williams. And I know what they do behind the scenes. you know, they've always been extremely supportive in the community, and it's something that the world don't know about. But they're incredible, and I just want everyone else to do the groundwork and show acts of solidarity by, you know, just speaking out, man, and doing something about this and getting this and provoking this change together.
Lavelle Moten is my guest. I've been saying this all week long, that this is a conversation that's going to make a number of you uncomfortable, but it's time, I think, that we all get comfortable being uncomfortable. He's the head basketball coach at NC Central. He is Hattie Mack's baby boy. He is Lavelle Moten. Lavelle, I appreciate you very much, and I appreciate your thoughts. Thank you very much for coming on and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate you having me.
Appreciate you, Coach. Lavelle Moten.